You're listening to the Body Pros CME and CE podcast coverage of CROI 2008, the 15th Conference on Retroviruses and Opportunistic Infections. This is part of a podcast series summarizing key HIV research from CROI 2008. To listen to the rest of this series, visit us online at thebodypro.com/CROI2008.
This is Bonnie Goldman, editorial director of The Body Pro. I'm here with Dr. Cal Cohn, research director of Harvard Vanguard Medical Associates and Community Research Initiative of New England in Boston, Massachusetts. He's also a clinical instructor at Harvard Medical School and has been providing HIV care since the beginning of the pandemic. Dr. Cohn is going to provide a summary of breaking research from CROI 2008 regarding the management of treatment-experienced patients, including news about recently approved antiretrovirals and antiretrovirals in development.
Thanks very much. At this conference, we continue to see some reassuring news that the progress we've made with new antivirals as well as new tools to use them and use them well has borne fruit, and we have reassuring data at this conference that we are making progress. One way to get at that was a study presented to us from the Vancouver group. In Vancouver, they're able to monitor essentially all of their patients over time and take a look at how well they're doing virologically over the past decade of antiviral treatment. And one way to get at that is that they looked at the results of about 21,000 resistance tests that were ordered in several thousand patients over the past decade. To take a look at, first of all, how well are we doing at virologic suppression, and what are we seeing on resistance assays? And the results are pretty striking. A decade ago, there were lots of new cases of resistance observed on resistance testing. In 2007, there's a dramatic decline. Indeed, 2% or fewer of the patients who had resistance testing done showed evidence of drug resistance. We see, in fact, the least amount of resistance in the protease class in these resistance tests that were ordered. In fact, only 8 new cases of protease resistance were reported by that group. Perhaps this is not surprising, since they also reported to us that the percent who are achieving viral loads less than 50 copies is about 90%. In an outpatient setting in Vancouver, a pretty optimistic outcome. I mean, it was technically around 86%, but certainly doing better than we did just years ago. So it's not a surprising finding that we don't see resistance, because when these meds work, we don't see resistance. And so perhaps that progress is attributed to the fact that we have new and very good successful regimens, not just for starting therapy, but new regimens for people who are already on therapy. So let's review some of the new drug classes as a way to start, since we saw for the first time at this conference data about a new CCR5 inhibitor called Vicrivirok, or Vicrivirok. This is a drug that's been in development for a few years. It's the second CCR5 inhibitor to have some phase 2 data, in addition, of course, to the already approved Maraviroc. The Vicrivirok study is called VICTOR, or V-I-C-T-O-R, VICTOR-E, one trial, and we saw the results of this phase 2b study at this meeting. These are treatment-experienced patients who go on one of two doses of Vicrivirok. It does require ritonavir boosting, so everybody was on at least 100 milligrams of ritonavir as part of their background regimen. In this study, about 40 people per arm were randomized to one of three arms, either Vicrivirok at 30 milligrams a day, 20 milligrams a day, or a placebo arm. And the goal was to see how well we're doing with virologic suppression after a year. Just to give you some idea of who the patients were, the mean CD4 count was around 200 cells, and their viral load was around 4.5 log, which is around 30,000 copies or so. And then in this study, in terms of the background regimen, only about a third of the patients used darunavir for the first time, and only about a quarter used enfuvirtide. So certainly these regimens were not necessarily all that powerful in terms of their background regimen, and yet the results are reasonably impressive. Indeed, if we take a look at those patients who got Vicrivirok by the number of active drugs, we can see how well Vicrivirok adds to a background regimen. Now, if a patient had no active drugs in their background regimen, we can see in terms of the percent who achieved less than 50 copies that almost 30%, it was actually 29%, on the higher dose got to less than 50. But if we contrast that with those patients who had a regimen with two or more active drugs in their background plus Vicrivirok, then about 80% achieved less than 50 copies in this study. An impressive finding for a new drug in a new class. And so I think this was pretty optimistic and pretty reassuring data for the field that this drug is active and certainly does achieve the kind of suppression that we needed to in these patients. There also wasn't much of a safety signal in this study. It looked reasonably well tolerated, and we saw some evidence in terms of reassurance around liver function tests, as well as about blood levels, to suggest that this drug certainly does achieve virologic suppression in a pretty well-tolerated overall regimen. We also saw some additional data from Maraviroc, and the MOTIVATE trials were updated out to week 48, and for the most part, those patients who achieve virologic suppression at week 24 continue to do so to week 48. And this is, again, not a surprise, but a piece of reassurance that we need when we use new drugs and new classes, since getting to less than 50 has typically been durable, but we can't assume it. We want to see it, and so we saw it here. Now, in this study, we also saw that there were some factors that predict response other than background regimen, and they are the standard ones, like viral loads and CD4s. The higher the viral load is at baseline, the less likely we are to achieve suppression. The lower the CD4 is, the less likely we are to reestablish virologic suppression, regardless of the regimen. Nevertheless, the addition of Maraviroc increased the odds that we did get to viral loads less than 50 copies. And once again, we had some reassuring news about the safety of the drug. There wasn't much difference at week 48 versus what was reported to us at week 24 in prior meetings last year. And so overall, we've got some pretty good news about either of these two drugs as they move along, with, of course, Maraviroc being available. One of the challenges to that drug class, however, has been the trophile test, has on occasion missed some people who, while they appear to have R5 virus, when we look further with additional samples or additional testing, sometimes, in fact, have a dual tropic or X4 population as well. And unfortunately, when the patient has an X4 population in addition to R5, then Maraviroc offers little to no additional efficacy. And so at this meeting, we saw some of the first data about the enhanced sensitivity assay that's being developed by the group at Monogram, the group that have the trophile assay already available to us. The data are pretty reassuring that they are indeed able to establish an enhanced sensitivity assay. In that Vicryviroc studies that we have seen over the past couple of years, they were able to take those samples and do a comparison of a standard trophile with this now enhanced trophile. And so, for example, of some of the patients who had R5 tropic virus as judged by a standard trophile, some of them turned out to have a dual tropic virus when they were now done with the enhanced trophile assay. This, we think, is the kind of result we're going to need in order to be even more confident that when we get this trophile assay, we can know in whom is this drug likely to work and in whom is this drug unlikely to work with more precision than we have now. And I think we'll all look forward to having those data available to us and hopefully the drug commercially available to us as well. There was some data here also presented about another genotype test called Sensitrope and other assays that are trying to do what the trophile test does, but to do it either faster or with less cost. And unfortunately, the data for those was not as compelling in terms of sensitivity. Other tests, at least so far, seem to miss some of the dual tropism that's present in a population. And so, unfortunately, it's not yet clear that we have an alternative assay to the trophile, but perhaps we'll have a better trophile sometime, hopefully, later this year. We also saw some reassuring data about the integrase inhibitor, raltegravir, the other drug in a new class. And the benchmark studies that made such a dramatic impact in our field were now followed out to week 48. And the week 48 data pretty much reinforce the earlier week 16 and week 24 data that were presented last year. Still, after 48 weeks, about a doubling of the response rate, we've got now 2/3 of patients on average who have less than 50 copies on a raltegravir-containing regimen versus a placebo-based regimen, with the expected improvements in CD4 counts as a result of that enhanced suppression, with about 120-cell increase on raltegravir compared to a 50-cell increase without it. Now, there's been a fair bit of interest in understanding raltegravir and the background regimen, because while raltegravir is a relatively easy drug to use, I mean, it's almost certainly active in a wide variety of patients that we have, the question has been not so much what do I need to know about raltegravir, but what do I need to know about the regimen that goes with raltegravir so that I make sure this drug is durable? Now, historically, it's always been true, the more active drugs we add, the better, and that was reinforced here. Those patients with a genotype score of their background regimen of two or more did better than those with a zero. But we saw some very, very interesting analyses about how active does the background drug have to be in order to offer some additional activity. And so there are a couple of ways we got at that, but the folks at Merck did an analysis using a phenotypic score. And as the audience may know, when we do a phenotype for most drugs, there's what's called a lower cutoff and an upper cutoff. When a drug is active as judged by the lower cutoff, it should be fully active or near fully active. When the drug's phenotype is above the upper cutoff, we expect it to have little activity. And then, of course, there's the range in the middle. So a year or two ago, when Merck presented the data of Roltegravir with a regimen in which the drugs were judged as zero activity based on being above the lower cutoff, what they said was that the regimen achieved suppression in about half the patients. But many of us said, well, you're looking at the phenotype score above the lower cutoff, and the lower cutoff means the drug may not be fully active, but it's still pretty active. So this doesn't really guide me. What if the regimen is really inactive? What if the drugs by the phenotype score have so much resistance that by phenotype their fold changes above the upper cutoff? What if these drugs look really inactive as we understand them by resistance testing? Then how well does Roltegravir do? And the astounding result presented here, at least, is that we see similar activity of Roltegravir even with very compromised drugs as judged by phenotype testing. And so it was pretty impressive, certainly to me, that Roltegravir obviously should be given with two, if not three, active antivirals in total, and that continues to be the message. We always do better with a regimen of three active drugs. But how active those drugs have to be is subject of some uncertainty, and this particular analysis suggests that even if the drug has partial activity, that may be reasonable to use that drug if we don't have better choices. At least these data were reassuring that that gets us to a similar place. In terms of safety, there were no new signals at this particular meeting. Everything worked out quite well. And perhaps one of the most impressive slides of the past year was the absence of a safety signal and the presence of high degrees of efficacy. The benchmark trials perhaps ended with a very memorable slide of how well does Roltegravir do when it was paired with two of the most active drugs available during the studies, the combination of Enfuvirtide and Darunavir. And in this study, at week 48, patients who received Roltegravir, Enfuvirtide, and Darunavir, 89% had less than 50 copies at week 48. An astounding result, certainly a result as good as any treatment-naive patient starts to see on their first regimen. And so the reassurance we had from these studies was certainly reinforced here with some great data even a year later. So what about the newer drugs in existing classes? We've got nucleosides, non-nucleosides, protease inhibitors. What progress are we making there? Well, the newest non-nucleoside, etravirine, was recently approved by the FDA, and we now saw the week 48 results of the DUET trials. Those are the randomized trials that take a look at the activity of etravirine. And these double-blind placebo-controlled trials reinforced what we've seen earlier, which is that if you get to less than 50 at week 24, you seem to stay there for an additional 24 weeks. The week 48 data are very reassuring with continued CD4 improvements. Once again, of course, if you've got additional active drugs like Enfuvirtide, you'll do even better than people who don't use Enfuvirtide. Those lessons are still there. And just like with the benchmark trial, the folks at Tibotec did an analysis to look at how active does the background drugs have to be to establish suppression. And so they took a look at the activity of Darunavir, in part because everybody in this study was assigned to receive the protease inhibitor Darunavir. And when they look at the activity of Darunavir as judged by a fold change or phenotype below 10-fold versus below 40-fold, what was striking is that the results were pretty similar in the overall rate of getting to less than 50, meaning when Darunavir is fully active, the fold change is less than 10. And certainly when Darunavir is fully active with a good regimen, we do the best. About 80% got to less than 50 with Darunavir active, etravirine active, and at least one other drug. And so the results are pretty reassuring that while it's always great to have three fully active drugs, even when some of the drugs are compromised, we still establish suppression in a remarkable majority of these patients. And then finally, we had some additional information about Darunavir at this meeting, in part because some clinicians have been concerned about the earlier use of Darunavir in the sequence, mostly around the question of, if I use Darunavir earlier, And if there is viremia and if there is resistance, then what is the cross-resistance implications of using darunavir earlier on in the treatment sequence? So the study that could answer that is the TITAN study. This is a very large study. It was presented last year and already published, which addressed that question of people who were viremic on a prior regimen, but they were both darunavir and lopinavir naive. They had never taken either of those two PIs, and this was a comparison of darunavir and lopinavir. What the result overall was is that darunavir was non-inferior to lopinavir at reestablishing suppression, and indeed, if the lopinavir wasn't fully active, meaning if it was above tenfold in terms of phenotypic resistance, then darunavir was in fact a superior option to reestablish suppression. But we've already known that for a while. The focus of this was, well, what if I use darunavir, and what if it doesn't get me to less than 50? What do I see, and what are the implications? So there were a few patients in whom there was the use of darunavir, and there was viremia, and there were a few people in whom there were some mutations that arose on the darunavir arm. And so they compared the implications of those mutations to what was observed on lopinavir. And the good news here is that, again, while there were very few mutations in those on darunavir, there was also very little cross-resistance, meaning that after darunavir didn't work and didn't result in suppression, most patients still had essentially every protease inhibitor appear to be phenotypically fully active. Indeed, more so than what was observed on lopinavir, in which case after the use of lopinavir, there was some cross-resistance observed in some patients to some of the other protease inhibitors, not just to lopinavir, but some loss of activity to drugs like amprenavir and atazanavir. And that was not the case for those on darunavir. So this reasonably reassuring piece of news allows us to know that the earlier use of darunavir in the treatment sequence is safe to do, it appears certainly successful, and if there is not incomplete suppression, the resistance implications are few in terms of the activity of other PIs in the class. So overall, I think what I would say at this meeting is most of what we saw reinforces what we've learned for years. When we can find three active drugs, we can reestablish virologic suppression in the vast majority. Indeed, in many of these studies, it's about 90% of those who get three active drugs have a viral load below 50 a year later. And so the rules of the game are, can I find three active drugs? And I think at this meeting, we saw some information to suggest that three active drugs, even if the drugs are not fully active, can actually do pretty well. Which doesn't mean that we should choose less than fully active drugs when given the choice, but it does mean that if the best we have are three drugs and perhaps one of them is not at full activity, we still have reasons to be optimistic that that regimen can get the viral load back to less than 50 and keep it there for at least the first year and hopefully for years to come.
The opinions expressed by hosts or interviewees in this podcast do not constitute professional advice, should not be considered substitutes for professional services, and do not necessarily represent the opinions of Body Health Resources Corporation or its sponsors. Please see the full disclaimer online at thebodypro.com. If you have comments or questions, please contact us.
This has been part of a CME and CE podcast series summarizing key HIV research from CROI 2008. To listen to the rest of this series, as well as additional coverage of CROI 2008, visit us online at thebodypro.com/CROI2008.